With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and the author of Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls. Today's guest is the award-winning author, speaker and journalist, Elizabeth Uvubenene. Elizabeth's latest book, The Reset, is a wise, thoughtful and timely exploration of how we work and live. If you're struggling to make sense of your relationship with these things after 2020, and I certainly am, this is comforting, nourishing and inspiring. We talked about Malcolm Gladwell, Daniel Steele and the power of creative collaboration. Congratulations on your brilliant book.
Thank you so much.
But also, you know, because I've been self-employed for about 10 years now. But even so, there's lots of stuff about office and the way offices are run. I'm my own boss and my boss is the worst. I'd love to hear, actually, if there's any, like, you know, fiction, any novels where there are characters who you think are sort of have really good or really terrible working practices, or any offices or workspaces in books that you'd love to work or hate to work in.
I would say this is, I don't know if this is not a book, but I think the closest bit of chaos when it comes to work style that I'd probably love to work in is Peep Show. I think that I love the depiction of work in Peep Show with between Mark and Jez.
But I do love that that really nails like the sort of the dullness and like in corporate culture and the like really arbitrary rules. What about nonfiction? Because I know that you refer to a lot of texts in your book, and it's obviously lots of very extensive research. Books that have really, I don't know, moved you or enlightened you or even enraged you about work.
The work. I don't think that I've read a book that has enraged me about, because I probably wouldn't be reading it. I have a low tolerance and patience for things that just jar me. So either I really love something and I will gush about it and I'll tell, you know, I'll go on to the, you know, the biggest bounting and I'll tell all my friends and I'll do a WhatsApp group and I'll say, this is so great. Or I'm like, this is so rubbish. I'm not going to engage in it. So I live in a little bit of an echo chamber in that respect, where I have Marmite taste approach to books. Either I'm really like, this is life changing. So I don't think I've ever engaged in a piece of nonfiction book about work that I've totally just been like, this hasn't been great. But I can definitely read books about the workplace and think about ways that I would have done things differently or added a different perspective. And that's where I guess, you know, the first idea of my first book came out, when I read Lean In and by Sheryl Sandberg, and I guess her whole mantra of, you know, we have to lean in more and all of that sort of thing, which was, you know, great. But I guess it had that missing big puzzle. If you don't, you know, if you're not a white woman and a very, you know, upper middle class white woman, how do you navigate the workplace? Like, how do you kind of, you know, bring your full self to work and be accepted and all of those things. So I think, yeah, I never really, I think maybe because I understand what it takes to write a book and how tough it can be. So I really try not to even like, not slag off, but I really try not to be so critical of other authors a little bit.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think I'd not thought about this with Lean In. I'm a white woman who moves through the world with, you know, a lot of sort of unearned privilege and ease. And I found parts of that quite
difficult to stomach slash enraging. But only now I'm thinking, has that book spawned lots of really helpful, useful books like yours? Because people are sort of reading, like, I'm sorry, who is this for?
Absolutely. And I think that's the beauty of books, and especially nonfiction books. And because ultimately you're there to, like, you know, shift perceptions, you know, increase empathy, challenge, understand, all of these things. And I feel like, I always say this about Lean In. People always look back and say things, you know, it's not this and it's not that. But I always, you know, give kudos where it's due, because without Lean In, and what it did in terms of opening up the conversation around what it is to be a woman in the workplace, Elizabeth, who was 21 and who was, you know, in the city working, she would not have thought it was possible to write a book that was speaking about what it is to be a Black woman in a workplace. And look at what's happened, you know, following Slaying Lane and having so many other books written about the Black female experience. So it's critique is really important, especially when it comes to nonfiction books. But I'm such a big believer of, you know, it can launch 1,000 ships. And I definitely believe that Slaying Lane would not exist in the same way if Lee Ling didn't exist. So total kudos.
I'd love to hear about the books that you've been raving about on WhatsApp. What have you been recommending in the group chats? And what have you had recommended to you that you've loved?
I'm currently reading a book called Open Water by Caleb Nelson. I'm trying to get into fiction more because, you know, lockdown's been really hard, and I'm a non-fiction writer, so you need a little bit of escapism more and more. So that book has been really, and it's a short book as well, so I think, you know, if I'm getting into something, I like to kind of take a bit of baby steps. And I really love the writing in it. I love the themes around love, identity, and I just really, so far, enjoying it. So if someone's like, oh, what book you read, like, you know, what book should I read? I'm like, you know what, that book's a really good book. And I haven't finished, I don't want to do any spoilers, but I just love the fact that, you know, two central characters are Black, and there's the themes around love and unexpected things happening, and just, it feels just so, just full of energy, and he writes beautifully, absolutely beautifully. And I'm a sucker. I'm such a sucker for language. Like, honestly, love it. Like, I think it's, like, I always say, you know, it's not what people do, it's, you know, it's what they say. And I think the reason why I love books, I fell into writing, but one of the reasons why growing up I used to love English more than any subject was just the fact that I was really bad at maths, and maths didn't explain the world to me at that age when I was like 10 and I was reading books on my own, sort of thing. Numbers didn't explain certain things I saw around me, divorce, in terms of like my parents getting divorced, and you know, friendships and all of these questions I had about the world. Numbers didn't really explain it to me. It was all through like language and words. And I think that's why I loved books like such as Jacqueline Wilson and all of these kind of like childhood books, because it just made me really understand the world better.
Well, tomorrow, at the time of recording, so this will be in the past, I think, when people hear it, yeah. I am doing an event with Caleb at Bath Lit Festival. So I will tell him how much you love his book.
Please do.
I loved it too. I really loved it. And something, I found it really moving that he was talking, you know, with such honesty and vulnerability about being a man and being in love.
Yeah.
And you don't hear that very often. And it's a little while since I've read it now, but I have a memory of him talking in that book about his character, loving Zadie Smith, and talking about sort of Black artists and creators and writers. And I was wondering if that's come up, and if you've read much Zadie or felt moved to read any of her. But I also want to ask you about Jacqueline Wilson.
Yeah, and honestly, I feel like, I think people know that she's the GOAT. I think people get it. I think I'm 29 right now, and I can't meet anybody else who everybody gushes about Jacqueline Wilson and their impact, and her impact, sorry, on their lives. And I think the thing that I love the most about her books is it always had a perspective that I could relate to. And not because, you know, I grew up in very similar circumstances as some of her characters, but it didn't feel perfect. And I felt like when I was younger, I had challenges around understanding certain, I guess, things around me. And I knew my world wasn't perfect. And I felt like when I read books such as hers, it made me just feel better and comforted, because it wasn't the perfect nuclear family, you know, two white parents, and that it felt very, I don't know if the right word is dysfunctional, but I think that's what I loved about her books. There was that kind of gloss that just wasn't there, and I was able to read about different experiences. And I feel that that kind of like feeling that I have around why I like reading certain books now and write and that how I like to live my life is to kind of show that I'm not perfect. I am flawed. Life is flawed. And I felt like that was what I loved about her book, because it's about empathy as well. And I think I read for empathy. I read for greater understanding. And I think she's just, I think, yeah, I loved books such as, you know, Dusting Baby. Can't say enough about how brilliant she is.
You mentioned your parents divorcing when you were younger, and I was wondering whether you'd read The Suitcase Kid, because I had lots of classmates who were going through that. And what you were saying about reading for empathy, I think it gave me a much greater... It was something that I, you know, found from a distance quite hard to get my head around, and I was really lucky to be able to have a better insight into that experience, and in a way that, you know, worked for me when I was 8, you know, something as adult as divorce. And for her to write a story that's really, really smart and doesn't talk down to anyone and is so lively and love-filled, but also makes a very painful and complex thing quite clear.
Absolutely. And I think, like I said, it's the beauty of like books, and it's the beauty of fiction. And that's something I want to get back into, because that kind of feeling that I had as a kid where you escape into this world and you somehow believe everything is possible. As you grow older, you get a bit more pessimistic. You get, you know, it's kind of, you know, beaten out of you bit by bit in various different forms. And I think that Jacqueline Wilson really captured that feeling, and I think that she made me fall in love with books and reading, and like you said, taking complex emotional things that you may not understand, and as a child, and really breaking them down into really kind of pithy, interesting worlds. It's just, yeah, super, super inspiring. And honestly, like, she's made, I think, a generation of young people and people generally just super more empathetic and understanding of each other's experiences. And that's what you want as a writer.
Definitely. Can you remember the first book that you ever picked up that made you feel, for want of a better expression, grown up? You're like, this is for adults. Ooh. And I'm in that club now.
Of course I can. It was honestly Danielle Steel books. Danielle Steel's. Those are the books that I used to tell Yomi about, like, we have this love. Yomi's my best friend and person who I wrote Slaying Lane with. And I think we bonded over the fact that we used to read a lot of, like, Danielle Steel books, and we just knew that we shouldn't be reading those books. They were quite big and hefty as well, so I felt proper grown up. And what I used to do, because I used to read on the bus to work, read on the bus to school. And I think I was definitely secondary school, probably like 12, 13. And you get those big hardbacks, and you have the cover things on the hardback.
I like this, the slip.
Basically. The slip, yeah, the slip. I should really know what that is. But yeah, the slip.
No, it's there are lots of words, but...
And obviously, I didn't want people to know that I was reading her books. I would take the slip off, and I would literally just have this, you know, hardback that I'd be reading, and nobody would ever know. It could be the Bible for people. Like, honestly, it could have been anything at that point, because I was like, I wouldn't say I was embarrassed, but because I knew her books were a bit saucy and a bit older than like my years, I didn't need anybody realizing like what I was reading. So yeah, I think Danielle Steel books were definitely like my gateway into like this world of like adult books that had themes way beyond my years. That kind of led me to read books such as, you know, Mills and Boone's books, and I don't even understand why I was reading these books, but somehow I find myself reading all these romantic, like, sexual books around just like adult, like, themes that I should not have been reading. And I remember I would be in the library, I'd go to my local library, and I would feel so a bit embarrassed, but I wanted to read to go around that section. Is it the romantic novel sections? And that was like my guilty pleasure.
But I think it's so interesting because you're talking about, you know, getting older and getting more cynical. Mm. And those stories are very hopeful, aren't they? You know, it's all sort of, now I think, you know, as feminists, we could be like, well, you know, you shouldn't want to sort of, you know, go off with a shake or whatever you do in a Nelson Boone book. But it is that glorious, glorious escapism. It is so away from like any recognisable world. Are there any particular like Danielle Steel novels? Like, can you remember the very first one you read, or do they all sort of blur into one a bit?
No, if I'm honest with you, I can't remember the first one I read because they honestly just have, it was such a long time ago. And also I read so many that it all kind of blurred into one. But the books that kind of followed that were quite similar when it came to like Danielle Steel books were Tasmina Perry.
Oh, like, yes.
So when I kind of transitioned away from Danielle Steel books, because I would say complex, but I then started reading more Tasmina Perry books. And there's a book called Gold Diggers. And I absolutely loved this book. I still love, honestly, I probably need to, I'm talking about it right now, making me think I have to buy it after this and read it again. Because I just love the kind of glamour and the real like escapism and all these women just doing whatever. And it was set in London, and all her books had sensationalist titles. So like one was called Gold Digger, one was like Daddy's Girls, and one was like Guilty Pleasure. Like, I used to just be drawn to those books, and Tasmina Perry was definitely my kind of another guilty pleasure. And I don't want to say guilty pleasures because it's not, I don't want to say, because all these books, pleasure, not guilty pleasure.
Oh God, but I mean, I don't want this conversation to stop, but I think I'm going to download Gold Diggers as soon as, because I think I maybe read a couple of Tasmina Perry's, and if memory serves me, a little more than Danielle Steel, who I don't know so well again, and not for reasons of kind of joke, it's just I was Jilly Cooper, and then I had a real passion for the novels of Louise Bagshaw, who turned into the massively problematic Louise Mensch.
I used to read Louise Bagshaw, and she's got a sister, Tilly Bagshaw, that also writes books. Read all of those. So I'm with you.
Gosh, I think there is maybe, it might be called Career Girls, but those books,
yes.
Back to Work, they fetishized and glamorized and romanticized having this like big, sexy, exciting career as much as like the sexy men.
Absolutely. Honestly, I think when you said, was there any books earlier that I, in terms of novels, okay, I should have really thought about this because they really did. And they made me, because by this point, when I was reading like a lot of like Tilly Bagshaw's and all those types of books, I was 16, so I was being a bit more independent, and I was starting to think about my future a lot more. And those books definitely set me up for a world of work that was, you know, full of coffee, full of like early morning coffees and late nights and, you know, social stuff and just a level of glamour that the real world just doesn't have when you first get into the world of work. So they definitely made me, I kid you not, be so excited to get into the world of work and be an adult. Like, I think that was it. I was itching. I think every child, obviously, you know, when you're a teenager, all you want to do is become 21 and just live your life. I think those books definitely made me want to accelerate and jump towards to being 29. And I look back, I'm like, why was I rushing to be 29? Like, I'm 29 now. I'm like, why was I rushing? It's because of those books, in a good way. There was a real kind of energy and real glamour.
Was that your dream age? Was that your, like, your grown-up age, 29?
No, because I definitely would have thought, oh my God, that's so old. So definitely not my dream age when I was, like, 16. I think it was, I think 25 was, like, my dream age. It was like, yeah, I was like, yeah, she's 25. But when I read Pride and Prejudice as well, that was also a group of women that obviously were talking about marriage, and that's one of my favorite Jane Austen books ever. And another book I really need to read again, and I just love Pride and Prejudice, and that was another book that I read around that time that also obviously was set back in God knows when, but it was also a book that was speaking about themes that around marriage and all of these things that I was just so desperate to like, but not become, but I really was just very excited about being an adult.
And I suppose Pride and Prejudice, even though it's about marriage, it was written very much at a time when, you know, as a woman, marriage was your business. That, you know, what I guess I think the book is about is weighing up, you know, the craving and yearning for romantic love with having to make quite a sad and pragmatic decision about your future because your options are limited.
Absolutely.
What led you to Pride and Prejudice? What made you think, oh, I fancy that?
GCSE, I had no choice.
And were you pleasantly surprised to find yourself enjoying it? Or did you think, oh, this is going to be fun?
Definitely was like, oh, God, I have to read this book. So there was a real sense of dread. But I realised that I probably was going to enjoy it. Was probably when I opened the first page. And you know that the famous, you know, first line of Pride and Prejudice is, you know, it is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. And I absolutely was like, ooh, this could be Mills and Booms. This feels like themes that I really like reading. So it was like, so when I first read that line, I was like, because you had to read it according to what your teacher was like doing. So this was definitely GCSEs actually. So you had to read a chapter. So I think obviously we had to read with the class. So I remember actually that I didn't want to read with the class. I wanted to read it on my own pace, on the train home or on the bus home, all of that sort of stuff. And I think it's because, like you said, it had a real strong female character at the heart of it. It had themes that I was somewhat already used to. And I think my favourite character is the mum.
Yes.
Mrs. Bennett. That is like, she's my favourite character. And I remember when I had to do in GCSEs, you've got to read the book. And then, this was back in the day, so I'm not sure what the kids are doing now. But you had to do a speech. So you're given a question, you have to pick a character and then do a speech for like 10 minutes around this particular character. And so I picked Mrs. Bennett and I loved her character because I thought she was so full of life and she was just so eccentric and I just loved her character. So she was the person that I loved, obviously Elizabeth, loved her, but Mrs. Bennett was the one that I fell in love with.
Mrs. Bennett is brilliant. I often think sometimes I go on if I'm on a hen do, obviously it's been some time since that has happened. But, you know, there's someone, if it's, you know, it's been organised by like someone's best friend from school who I don't know and they're quite full on. And they love the hen admin. They're like, I will get the sashes printed. We are all going to be at this cocktail bar. We're all going to have little penis straws and all that planning. I'm like, you are post-millennial Mrs. Bennett. You have that vibe. Oh, you're a planner.
Do you know what? I love the fact that you said a post-millennial Mrs. Bennett. I sometimes fall into that. I'm not a great planner because I can leave things to last minute, a lot of important things. So if I, you know, if my best friend got married tomorrow, I would not be a great maid of honour by any means or great any responsibility. But I always say that sometimes I give off the kind of nonchalant, laid back persona, especially, you know, online. Sometimes you don't really know people, so you just get a version of them. And I'm always reminding people, no, I am very uptight. Do not take this for granted. Like, I am so uptight. And if you spend like more than a day with me, you realise that I am a post-millennial Mrs. Bennett, like very much like her.
That's brilliant.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
We'll be back to Elizabeth soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. This week I've chosen The House of Sleep by Jonathan Coe, the story of narcoleptic Zara, whose dreams are so vivid she becomes convinced they are real, Terry, who revels in his own insomnia, and the strange sleep scientist and researcher, Dr. Gregory Dudden. Coe's plot is complex and compelling, but it's his characters you really care about. Sparky, funny, smart and sad, this is one of my all-time favourite novels. The House of Sleep by Jonathan Coe is published by Penguin and out now. Now, back to Elizabeth. Did you ever read, this is a book about work that I loved so much, The Undomestic Goddess by Sophie Kinsella?
Yes, yeah. She's another one that I used to just love reading as well. And just on your point about how what people present and what the reality is, I think one of my favourite writers in the whole world is Malcolm Gladwell. Surprise, surprise, non-fiction writer says they love Malcolm Gladwell. There's no prizes there. And I think I love his writing because that element of, you know, what you present to the world and what the reality is, and so much of what we do as people, once the minute you leave your house and every single day to go to work, whatever, it's I would say it's a performance. Like, I think life is a performance and we are on a big stage. And I think when I read books like about kind of work and people and smart thinking books, I'm always looking for like interesting perspectives, and you can always count on, you know, Mr. Gladwell to take certain themes and tie it together and make it feel different and feel like, you know, very groundbreaking. Is really that kind of book that does make you think about what people present and what the reality is, and these are the reasons why these people have done, you know, really exceptional, but it's not for the reasons why you think. And I think that we are always kind of you're on a treadmill a lot in life, and you kind of do things and you don't know why you're doing them, but it's some of it's learned, some of this you pick up by your parents and things like that. So to have a book that kind of breaks it down and kind of, you know, flips these things, these themes around success, around, you know, ambition and getting ahead in life, and flips it in an interesting way, I think it's super interesting. And yes, one of my, you know, it's the book that I gift to people, like, it's definitely that book. Yeah, that's definitely the book that I give to people. And even when I buy it myself, every few years I find myself buying it because I'm like, you know what, I really need to read that again, jog my memory. And somebody would come to my house or you know, and I'll be like, you know what, I think we're having a conversation about life and just, you know after a glass of wine you're just chatting and you're like, you know what book you'd really like, you know what book that would really get you, you know, think, rethinking, you know, the way you approach life. And it's always that book that I will reach on my bookshelf and hand over and say, you keep it and try and return it to me when you're done. And nope, they never do.
I love to think that these books are kind of on journeys throughout the world. And then, you know, these people be having conversations saying, you must read this. But I've never read it. And I think I probably will before Tasmina Perry. It sounds brilliant. Does he write by sort of by case studies and studying specific people? Or does he? And are they known people or just examples that he knows?
A mixture. And I think that's what's so interesting, because it isn't, you know, it is a mixture of people that or very visible people that you may know. If there's a book that I wish I, when people ask me this, you know, oh, what is the book that you, I wish I wrote? I'm always reluctant to say any other book other than the first book I ever wrote, which is Staying Alone, because genuinely that's the book I wish I wrote. So I'm lucky. Secondly, it would definitely be any book that Malcolm Gladwell writes, because, as I said, I think he's, you know, one of the greatest spellbinding nonfiction writers of our time. And I think there's power in books and writing, that being able to kind of simplify big themes and add different contexts to it and present that to the world. I think it takes a lot of courage, in all honesty. I think being a writer and writing a book, like I said, fell into this whole world, and I don't take for granted every single book. So when I'm even sent a book, I always want to post it, even though I may not have read it, but I just want to just give props to that writer and give props to that book, because it, you know, behind that author, there's, you know, there's publicists, there's marketing, there's doubts, there's sleepless nights, there's so many different bits that make that book, you know, sitting there proudly in Waterstones or sitting there on an online bookstore.
Awesome. I can really, really feel and see and hear the Malcolm Gladwell in the reset, for sure. That sense of the voices.
No, thank you. That is I'm so glad you said it. I was fishing for that compliment. I'm joking. No, that is such a compliment, and I'm taking it with a pinch of salt.
Well, I think it's very true. But I love that I do believe every single thing we read, whenever we read it, we hold it and we take what we need from it. And I guess it's back to what you're saying about lean in, even though there was plenty not to love and not to agree with in that book. Mm. It's still, you know, I think books push us, and I love that, you know, we're lifelong learners. And also I think maybe we learn as much from Danielle Steele as we do from Sophie Kinsella and Malcolm Gladwell and Jane Austen, all in different ways.
Absolutely. And it can be, and like, there's a reason why at that age where I was looking at books, I was like, oh, I shouldn't be reading this. It's because there is that. And even now, talking about it, it can feel very like, this is a smart thinking book, so therefore you should be reading this type of book as opposed to this type of book. And it always bothered me when people used to say stuff like, you know, chick lit and all of that. I just feel like it was, number one, very sexist. And the books that people read they tend to be the books that kind of fall into that category. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't necessarily feel like they're, and it can feel very snobby sometimes when people talk about one book versus the other, or one category of book versus the other. Because that's just, yeah, I think every, it's just, yeah, I think it does a disservice to the power of what a book does, generally.
For sure. And I think over the last year, I've definitely kind of found myself reaching for soft landings and rereading, and not necessarily wanting to challenge myself, and trying really hard to, but also sort of maybe alternating my books a bit. And I think it's really good for me to read something that I'm not necessarily drawn to, because if I just read what I wanted to read, I'd probably just read like The Man Who Made Husbands Jealous over and over and over again. Did you notice any changes over the last complicated year? I know you said you were trying to maybe read more fiction.
Yeah.
Is that because fiction sort of feels more fun, that you can, like, with nonfiction, it's sort of justified as like, it's, I'm reading, but I'm doing something productive?
I think my habits, because I was writing the reset over lockdown, so, and I don't like reading while writing, especially as an author. I like to just write within a vacuum, and that's probably why it was really hard to write this book, if I'm being so honest, because writing a book about how we work and live, and this is the idea I came up with the idea pre the pandemic, but writing this book under the pressure cooker of, you know, a pandemic and people talking about these themes every single day, either on radio, either, you know, on online articles, and just everyone just talking about these themes, I think it made writing really hard. And I think you can't write for other people as well. And you can't, I think those are the books that, I mean, it can get quite navel-gazing, and, you know, you're writing because, you know, someone's going to be like, oh, that's a great point. And you can't, you just have to write from that kind of like, from your heart. And I think that's why I love about fiction sometimes, because there is that real sense of, and I think that's why I'm really loving Caleb Nelson's book Open Water, because it, there's a real vulnerability. And sometimes with nonfiction, it's hard. Like, I would say maybe nonfiction books around work and all of those things, they don't feel as vulnerable personally. And I think what I love about fiction, why I'm you know, giving myself this rule to, for the rest of the year, pick up more fiction books off my bookshelf, is because I just believe that the best books have vulnerability at the heart of them, but the best stories start from that. And I think that to be a great writer, to be a great speaker, to be a great anything in this life, like, you need people to connect to what you're saying. And I think that books really do that, and I feel like the best books have that at the heart. And I think that's why I think my reading habits have become more attuned to me trying to get that vulnerable Elizabeth back, the optimist and the person was so hopeful about the future, and didn't know what 29 would look like at all, but still wanted to basically be a bit older because that was where it felt fun, it felt glamorous. And I think, yeah, so absolutely, I feel like it has changed my lockdown, definitely changed, and what happened over the last year or so has absolutely changed my reading habits. And because if we don't have hope, and that's what fiction does, then what do you really have?
Oh, that's so true and so wise. I'd love to hear about books that are coming up, anything that's on your shelf or, you know, on your bedside table, not to rush you through Open Water because it's so beautiful. Take your time. But
no, is there honestly,
I'd love to hear about what you're looking forward to reading.
I've been sent Dr. Sophie Mort, A Manual for Being Human. So I've been sent an early proof of it. I'm super, super, super excited to actually read it because she talks about, you know, happiness and how to live a happier life in a very practical way, and how the fact that, you know, we don't tend to, do you think she talks about, you know, loads of people are struggling and we don't know why. And she talks about the fact that, you know, we're not raised to understand ourselves, and we are raised, you know, to in fact misunderstand ourselves, and, you know, fearing the thing that makes us really us. And I love stuff like that. I absolutely love, like, ideas around that and ideas around happiness. So, and she's a, you know, she's a therapist, so I'm totally, what's the word, excited to kind of, I guess, weirdly detox. So I think after I finish Open Water, I might start that for sure. And then I'm looking forward to reading Ortega Wagba's Let's Talk About Money, because I love books that just talk about uncomfortable situations and uncomfortable conversations. And I think that, you know, money is, like, you know, being one of the most awkward conversations to have. What I said about reading fiction, those are my two exceptions for the rest of the year.
Oh, but that, the Manual for Being Human sounds brilliant. And Ortega's book is, I've been like dreaming of that. I mean, desperate to read that for ever since she mentioned writing it. And I think there are so many books about money, but so few. And I think she is absolutely going to do this, that are sort of really emotionally intelligent about it and say, this is why this thing is so painful. And it's exactly what you were saying about maths, you know, when you were younger, be like, this doesn't help me make sense of the world. And the idea that, and all writing about money, it seems to be like, it's either take your spare £100,000 and put it in the savings account, or have you thought about giving up coffee? And neither of those help.
Oh my God.
So I'm just about to start. Because we need to talk about money.
Yeah.
I can picture the proof, but, you know, sometimes when the title, but that's, I know it's just going to be brilliant. And I think probably a really great companion read to The Reset and the subject of work, how capitalism is screwing us all. Do you know a book, I think it might be called Real Life Money by Claire Seal, who's My Frugal Year on Instagram.
I do. Yeah, she's brilliant. Absolutely. And she tackles the conversation about money in such a helpful, emotionally intelligent way as well. And I just love the fact that we're talking about it, and we're talking about it in a way that we should have been talking about this. And it's, you know, through so many reasons, it's always been men that are, when you read a lot of nonfiction books and nonfiction reads around money, it does, you know, tend to be, over the years anyway, personally growing up, and that has always kind of turned me off, and therefore then made me not be open about talking about money. So I'm loving the fact that us women are talking about it, and we're talking about it in a different way as well. We're not adding to the noise. We are, you know, dismantling a very traditional, limiting conversation and making it super interesting and fun and hopeful and optimistic. Because, like I talk about in The Reset, the activity of work reminds us that we have, you know, the power to build our own futures, because that is why we go to work every single day. That is why we kind of get up. And if you don't have that kind of hope that you can do that, then what are you doing it for, essentially? So it is that hope that, you know, we kind of like I feel like is really important. And I talk about it in the sense of a good life. What does a good day look like? And if everything you're working on right now, would it ladder up to what you deem to be a good life? Not a perfect life, not if you won $1 million tomorrow, whatever, not that. I don't know why I say dollars, pounds.
Mind you, the exchange rate being what it is, maybe dollars
gosh, don't even, exactly. that's exactly why I think it's important for us to kind of keep having these very uncomfortable, interesting conversations. And books do that.
And especially it comes back to what you're saying about empathy. I think there's so much shame around money, and also so many for women. And what I loved so much about, not, you know, being a mad Sophie Kinsella fangirl, but when I was a teenager and reading that first Shopaholic book and that beginning of just that don't panic, and really thinking, oh, you're allowed to write books about this. And you're allowed to write about this serious, terrifying thing in a really, really, really funny way. And just that she was allowed to want stuff, you know, and this sort of idea that, you know, I think we see in culture that if a man buys a watch or a sports car, he's, you know, earning it and he's all right. Whereas, you know, what women are judged for everything always, all day long. But, you know, what we choose to spend our money on, it's... And just this idea, as you said, that we can live well, and we can be just by living for ourselves, we're living a good life. And I think Absolutely. That's so hard to do. And that's why I'm going to be reading A Manual for Being Human.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I just love the fact that so many books, and you know what, apart from, see, Mark and Gladwell, that I've gushed about enough on this podcast, I'm so happy that all we've spoken about are female authors, fiction, non-fiction, through the years, modern, you know, more just different types of books, and they're all like the books written by women, and I just love it. I love that for us.
It's brilliant. It's really, really exciting. Would you ever write fiction? Is that something that you're thinking about? Or
probably not. So we have, me and Yomi have an announcement. I'm not sure exactly when this podcast is coming out, but we do have a cheeky bit of an announcement over the next couple of weeks around something to do with fiction. So yeah, so that's fiction, and it's super interesting. And in terms of like fiction for myself, I don't, honestly, I would say that, being honest, like The Reset will probably be the final book that I write for a long time. Like, I feel like I'm 3 books in 3 years. I think it's, you know what, I think I'm just gonna just, you know, spend a few years living and then see what happens. But I definitely feel like I want to have a bit of a hiatus away from publishing for a while.
I completely understand and respect that. However, I would put $1 million on, you know, in 6 months to a year, you saying, like, I've got an idea, and having a... I don't think we can keep you away from books and publishing. But, and I'm sure you've talked about this a lot before, but I'd love to know, what is it like to collaborate with your best friend? How do you kind of complement each other's sort of strengths, and do you find yourselves, each other, like taking on different roles, or does it work because you think in a similar way?
It's so interesting, because like, I wonder if Yomi would agree, but we work effortlessly with each other when it comes to writing, and just generally, like, I would say we work so much more. Like, I honestly, like, I'm not saying it's always easy to work with your best friend, and I think we've had challenges over the past couple of years, like absolutely like anybody would, but I would definitely say that we have such an ease in the way that we divvy up roles, and we have such an ease in the way we kind of write, because we've written fiction, we've written non-fiction together a few times, now we're writing fiction together, and even that was seamless. Like, do you know what I mean? And I think that probably is testament to the fact that we do have different personalities, but we're quite similar, but we've known each other for 10 years plus. So even before the books, we had a real understanding of each other's characters and personalities. And I think that's the thing about work, regardless of if it's with your best friend or whatever. I'm a big believer in, you know, when you understand somebody better, you make allowances, and not in a way that means that you're allowing them to get away with murder and whatever, but you make allowances because that's what people do. You're accommodating to other people's feelings, you're accommodating to, you know, how they like to work. And I feel like that for me is a sweet spot of like work, basically. And sometimes we do, when we talk about work, and that's why with the reset, I just wanted to kind of inject things such as trust, empathy in how we talk about the future of work and not just about, you know, technology and Zoom and the practicalities of it. Because I think I see that for myself with working with a best friend. I think that the reason why we've been able to do it for so long and be, you know, somewhat successful at it is because we have that at the core of how we work. So overall, it's a true blessing to do it.
Oh, Elizabeth, I have to tell you, the chapter on when talking about trust as a value in your book kind of broke me, because I'm like, I don't trust myself. I don't trust anyone. And realizing even though it's on me to get everything done, you know, I work assuming like no one trusts me and I can't be trusted in this like position of like fear. And I'm in the middle of doing the edits on my next novel at the moment. And I just feel,
can't wait.
Oh, thank you. That's very, like, I was going to say, not sure you'd say that if you could see it, but like, no, I shouldn't. I should be very positive.
Honestly,
about things.
Like, I just want to say congratulations on all your success, because, and I just want to say thank you as well, because personally, when I sent you the reset, I just really love the way you embraced it. And we've never met before. Obviously, we're seeing each other on Zoom now. So I just want to say thank you so much for all your support. It does mean a lot. And I literally can't wait to read your books as well. Because, yeah, like I said, it's a fiction year. And you're brilliant.
Oh, well, I'm really, really touched and moved. That is so lovely of you. Thank you. And I'm so happy that we're doing this. And yeah, I think it's lonely. And what you were talking about with collaboration, and I think now more than ever, and maybe after this last year, it's so nice to have this network of, you know, writers and women just wanting to really lift each other up and celebrate each other. And I was so excited. I keep holding up the reset, this beautiful book, as though this isn't an audio podcast, as though people can see it, they will see it. But
your book is stunning as well. The artwork's absolutely beautiful.
The amazing, amazing Becky Gaia. I feel like every time someone says that, I should, you know, write her a check. How old am I? I don't think we still have checks, do we? But
send her a ping on Monzo.
You know, yeah, exactly. As you say, that awareness of just, you know, it really does take a village to make a book, and that, you know, now there are, you know, so many working. So I love that I think if we can take anything from, like you're saying, this year, these times, but we, you know,
these strange times
going back in, but it has been, I think, a time of reading, and, you know, books have certainly soothed me, and that's been my point of connection and of humanity and of hope and trust.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's exciting about, I guess, reading at this point, because I'm such a believer that when you're at the most kind of like vulnerable, and you're like, this time it's going to birth a lot of beauty and a lot of ideas and a lot of different types of books, because we are forced to rethink so many things about the way things were done, and we're forced to kind of lean into the unknown a little bit more. And I think that's where you're going to find a brilliant idea. If somebody's going to literally be like, I'm going to write about this because we've never had this really weird, strange time, and now this has made me jogged a memory about this, and I think it's just like super, super interesting and super exciting.
Huge thanks to Elizabeth. The Reset is published by Hodder Studio and out now. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Thank you so much for listening to this conversation and lending us your ears. You can follow Your Book on social media. We're at YBooked. Look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests, and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends. Thanks so much to everyone who's left a 5-star review. It's the best way to help other people to discover us and discover new books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Elizabeth on acast.com/booked and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. For now, I leave you with this from Balthazar Gracian. A synonym is a word you use when you can't spell the other one. See you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.